Hello and welcome to another episode of Consumer, the European podcast of the Consumer Choice Center. As always, I'm your host, Bill Wirtz, with Billy Joel's Pressure fading out in the background. Very special episode for you today. The CCC just came back from a staff retreat in the Republic of Georgia. And so I wanted to take the opportunity to give you something else. This special episode will have different staff members of the Consumer Choice Center on the program, and also this podcast was recorded, so in the near future you will also be able to access it on the Consumer Choice Center YouTube channel. So take it away.
This is actually the first podcast episode that we do with a couple of people, and the first one that we're actually recording, so you can see our beautiful faces. Just before we start, I think it makes sense to just introduce very briefly what we do at the CCC, so our listeners get a view on that. So, Fred, we'll start you off.
Yeah, hello. Thank you very much, Bill. I'm Fred Roeder. I'm the Managing Director of the Consumer Choice Center. We're an international consumer advocacy group focusing on allowing consumers to have the freedom to choose and also promoting new technologies and innovative products and services, which often are regulated in a way that consumers cannot access them, which is very unfortunate. And we love technology, science, and progress, and therefore we advocate for smarter regulations that allow consumers to access cryptocurrencies, ride shares, supersonic passenger jets, you name it.
We also do lots of research in various areas. So we cover lots of lifestyle regulations, various digital issues, especially when it comes to the European Union, and then transportation, in particular, that concerns our European Railway Index, 22 and the 21. And then we do lots on the sharing economy, in particular, when it comes to various sharing economy services, how whether consumers can access them, whether it's possible for us to engage in this peer-to-peer exchange.
Awesome. Hi, I'm Elizabeth Hicks. I'm a U.S. Affairs Analyst at the Consumer Choice Center. So really echoing what these two just said, we focus on a lot of these issues, and I really take that into the U.S. and try to expand the consumer choice there for the United States citizens, and excited to do this podcast today.
Yep, thank you so much. My name is Luca Zagania. I'm the resident graphic designer here at Consumer Choice Center. So essentially, my responsibility is to create all the visual material that goes along all of our content. I'm also the newest member in the team, and really happy to be here today. And thank you so much for including me in the podcast.
All right. I wanted to start us off on, we'll discuss a few topics here, and we'll just get everyone engaged in the conversation. Obviously, we're still in the middle of a pandemic, but we never know where the start and finish is. Fred, you've worked, you've written a lot about vaccines, how we could have gotten vaccines quicker and easier. It's good, a little bit of an overview as to what you think could have been done, because I think we've covered a few of your articles that were very interesting and made points that seem sometimes counterintuitive, like the price of the vaccine that you talked about. So just a little bit of an overview there.
Yeah, and as unfortunate we are with this COVID situation, we can actually be all very happy about the fact that there are already vaccines on the market. I mean, it took less than a year to get vaccines on the market, and multiple vaccines, which is also good because we see some of them don't work for certain age groups or certain strains of the virus. So it's great that we have more than just one vaccine, but many vaccines on the market, and also some very new ways of developing vaccines. So the Moderna and the BioNTech vaccines are both mRNA vaccines. They were basically generated thanks to gene editing. It's a topic I know, Bill, you have been talking a lot about, especially in agriculture, but also in medicine. It's a really new, fantastic technology that also received the inventors of it received the Nobel Prize, I believe, 2 years ago. Last year. It took Moderna, for instance, the biotech company, it took them 48 hours to develop the vaccine. 48 hours. In the past, it has took companies and researchers 5 to 10 years to develop a vaccine. So this is amazing. Now the question is, why did it still take 8 to 9 months to get to the first patients. And regulation is a problem of this because the regulatory framework for vaccine approvals has been designed in a time when it took a decade to develop a vaccine. So you had also more time to set up the studies and trials. And I mean, fortunately, and actually that's something where I would praise regulators, is that most countries authorized emergency authorizations of the vaccines, so they were able to go faster than the typical approval process. And now you can see it that actually now regulators just start actually formally approving these vaccines. Some countries were quicker than others getting these vaccines to their people, and that allows you maybe also quicker to go back to normal. While maybe a no COVID policy might not be possible, and we still don't know if COVID is here to stay or if it will just disappear. That's virologists are currently trying to figure this out, but the vaccines massively reduce the severity of the disease, which is probably the most important thing, that less people die and the health system doesn't get overwhelmed. And unfortunately, many countries and blocs, such as the European Union, were just very stingy when it came to buying these vaccines. So the EU, I think, spent only a third of what Israel is paying for the BioNTech Pfizer vaccine. And at the same time, I did crunch some numbers and wrote about it as well. We have like, is it 600 billion, the EU recovery fund, or is it a trillion?
It's 750 billion.
750 billion euros in a COVID recovery fund. So it's apparently easy to spend, print and spend a lot of money. But then if we would have spent 250 euros per vaccine doses, so 500 euros per vaccine, at least those where you need to get two, would have still spent less than the EU recovery fund. So that's, I think you Americans call it penny stingy, pound foolish. No, how is it called? Okay. Penny wise and pound foolish. I think that's the expression. So, and that's something where you can see that some countries were eager to quickly spend money on vaccines, which of course then also creates incentives to set up more production capacity. But we also need to be a bit realistic about this situation. So it's a new situation that suddenly everyone is buying lots of vaccines, countries. And these mRNA vaccines, which are totally new technologies, and you need lots of different ingredients going in the manufacturing process, and you have a complicated cooling and supply chain. So there's just not the massive global capacity to manufacture 15 billion vaccines in a month. Mm-hmm. And taking away the patents of these manufacturers will also not do it, because it's just about know-how, it's about supply chains, and gradually the manufacturing capacity fortunately has been increased. So we hopefully will have a quicker supply to vaccines, but also governments need just to acknowledge that you don't want to be cheap on this.
So we have three other people here from three different countries. And so I just want to get a bit of a background for you, because now we talked a bit about the policy, but now about the practicality. How was it for you to get the vaccine? Whoever wants to go first, it's kind of the way you got it and how complicated it was and what you had to do and how long you ultimately waited.
So I'm from the United States, and it was pretty accessible pretty early on, I would say. For me personally, I got my vaccine to come here to Georgia to be with you all. I ended up getting the Johnson & Johnson vaccine, which was very convenient to just get the one shot and be done. And it was really easy to get. So for us, we had the U.S. has a vaccine.gov website, and it shows you all of the places where vaccines are available, what type of vaccine is available, and if you need to make an appointment or if you can just walk in. So for me, there weren't actually many Johnson & Johnson vaccines available around me. I'm assuming a lot of people took advantage of the one shot and done. And so I actually went to a different county and just walked into a pharmacy and got my vaccine. So it's pretty easy. It took literally 5 minutes to do, and I was out of there. So nice and easy.
I can go. So I'm from Ukraine, but I got my first dose of Moderna vaccine in the UK. So in the UK, it's also quite simple to get the vaccine. Well, there were different stages for people of different ages. So once vaccines became available for under 30, I signed up. It's accessible to everyone, regardless of your immigration status. You just need to go on the NHS website, you sign up, then you get your appointment date. there it's very busy in the sense many people sign up to get a vaccine. So you need to wait a couple of days. So potentially some people travel to different cities so they can get vaccinated. But overall, it's all quite simple. And in the UK, it's a bit probably different from many EU countries, because for Moderna vaccine, you have to wait more than 2 months before you get your second shot of the vaccine. And in Ukraine, for comparison, it's becoming also easier now. They've set up vaccination centers, massive vaccination centers in big cities, so everyone can enter and get vaccinated, although it doesn't work in the way it works in the UK. We have to sign up. Many people just queue up and get that dose of vaccine.
Okay, so I'm from Georgia. Well, it's nice to hear that you had an easier time, because I cannot certainly say that I had the same experience around here. As a matter of fact, I think it was one of the toughest experiences to get to the vaccine itself. To start off, before the vaccination even, there was a total lack of information, or in fact, misinformation from the government side on a massive degree. Starting from the beginning of the year 2021, we were receiving completely different information about when the vaccines would be available, what kind of vaccines would be available, when we would be able to get starting them, how the registration should have looked like. And essentially, you know, there was no way for us to actually start planning any of our activities of how to get a vaccine or what we were going to get. I myself had to get Sinovac, so I'm kind of waiting for Pfizer to become available again. The registration process itself was pretty hectic, if I may say so. We were relegated to using a government website for registrations, which I should say proved to be one of the least reliable websites in my recent experiences. Completely unreliable in terms of stability. I remember I had to go through the registration process 5 times until I could receive the confirmation, because at some stage it would definitely crash. And you know, it was pretty tough to figure out how other people actually signed up, because despite the instability, some of the places actually were filled up beforehand. So I might actually think there's some nepotism at play. Currently I'm trying still to register for Pfizer because website is even more unstable than before. I think I'm on my 11th attempt at the moment, so I'm still not giving up hope for it. But hopefully I'm getting my Pfizer shot sometime in August. Fingers crossed.
Can I also?
Sure.
So as someone who has received 3 vaccines so far, and I think in 2 weeks I get my 4th shot, it was also interesting. So I first got the Sinopharm vaccines in February, which was nice to kind of quickly be done with it. And now you can get, I live in the UAE, and you can get Pfizer boosters. And it was actually interesting when I walked in the vaccine center recently to get the Pfizer booster. You have like a touch screen in front of you, and you can pick if you want AstraZeneca or Pfizer, and it prints you out a different ticket. I mean, that's like consumer choice on steroids, I would say.
Yeah, some different experiences there, and where you see that the governments react to it differently. Some governments are a bit quicker than others. Ultimately, if it had been organized privately, I think it would have been a lot quicker. But moving to another topic, we just got the news recently. The European Union is phasing out the internal combustion engine. That means no more petrol and diesel cars, which reduces consumer choice significantly. And I know, Fred, you have a lot to say about that, but I wanted to first get Liz's view on that, because you just recently produced an index that shows accessibility of electric vehicles, which seem to be, well, I mean, hydrogen cars is a thing, but if somebody crashes into you, you blow up. So we're still not entirely there yet on some of that technology. Electric vehicles are the alternative there, but government regulation often comes in the way of consumers actually accessing it. So, Liz, what was your findings there?
Yeah, it was really interesting. So the U.S. Electric Vehicle Accessibility Index, we were inspired to create it because there's a lot of talk about, like you mentioned, moving towards electric vehicles, phasing out the internal combustion engines, and getting rid of petrol and diesel and things like that. In the U.S., Biden's administration has earmarked $100 billion to electrify the transportation sector, which I think is noble to help reduce emissions and improve the climate. The unfortunate thing that we found, though, is there are a handful of regulations that are preventing consumers from having access to purchasing and owning electric vehicles. So what we found is 2 major regulations get in the way. One is a direct sales ban. So you cannot buy a car directly from a manufacturer, you have to go through a dealership, and that is in over half of the states in the U.S. And then also in over half of the states in the U.S., once you purchase an electric vehicle, the licensing and registration fee is sometimes upwards of 300% more than it would be to register your regular standard passenger diesel or gasoline car. So it was very shocking to see. And if we want to move towards electric vehicles, I personally think there should be choice in the market. But if we are pushing towards electric vehicles, we need to open up the market to allow consumers to have access to them.
Luca, you're here in Georgia. How feasible would having an electric car even be if the petrol and diesel will be phased out? You own a car, right? You drive as well. Like, some countries in Central and Eastern Europe are as equipped, I would say, on the infrastructure as Georgia is. How would that work out, do you think, in practice?
Yeah, thank you. Now, I do not think we're in any way prepared to completely phase out the traditional combustion engines in any capacity. We do not have the adequate infrastructure for charging electric vehicles. I don't think the market in terms of consumers is ready to adopt electric vehicles yet, just because of the price tag on them. So, you know, this will create a massive issue within the consumers and, you know, essentially force them into either abandoning a car completely or pay exorbitant prices, which many people cannot afford here. You know, the question arises, like, why should they be relegated to those choices? So, yeah, to make it short, I think Georgia is not prepared in any way to completely transition to electric vehicles.
If I can just add something to this. So we have this debate now in Europe, or this political will to ban the internal combustion engine, and we'll see what will happen in the U.S. But this will actually cause a lot of unintended consequences, which will be really bad for developing countries. Because if you have ever been to a port in Hamburg or in Rotterdam, you see lots of cars that are being shipped to other parts of the world, used cars. You see it even here in Georgia on the streets, that you see sometimes some delivery cars that still have some Tischler Heinemann or whatever, like it's just a former German car used in Germany for a business. And when we produce much less vehicles, much less traditional internal combustion engine vehicles, probably a lot of automotive manufacturers have already said that they're not going to manufacture these internal combustion engines from 2027 or 2030 on. Yeah, where will the used cars come from, right? And it will just make things much more expensive. You will not have the charging infrastructure here. And I mean, currently, actually, used electric vehicles are extremely expensive. I recently purchased a car, internal combustion engine, big engine, 4.8 liters, beautiful sound. But I'm not against electric vehicles, right? And I checked what a used Tesla cost, and it was like three times the price of a really good used car with an internal combustion engine. So there's just, if you're price sensitive or want to have something nice but not spend a fortune, it's not really possible. So we're exporting again a lot of problems to countries that actually cannot afford facing these problems. And probably a shortage of supply of used cars and secondhand cars will hurt economies in Africa and Asia quite a bit.
If I may. Just a quick addition to that as well. The entire argument completely ignores the geographic side of the kind of situation as well, because it seems like the idea was entirely oriented on the cities, you know, and while you can still kind of argue that cities can be equipped with the necessary infrastructure for transition, take an example of a country like Georgia, which has very mountainous terrain with a lot of reasonably isolated areas where there's no way we would be able to install any sort of charging stations at all. And, you know, it completely ignores the people living in those areas, which would be facing a completely new challenges in terms of just moving around. So that's an additional thing that I think should be considered as well.
Yeah, I think those are some great points. And we often see these with environmental policies. It's usually people on higher incomes that advocate for them, but they're mostly the consequences are paid by people on lower incomes. And I think that's very unfair. What I see in Amsterdam, living in Amsterdam now, is that I can rent my share now electric smart car and, you know, I go my 3 kilometers and I feel great because it's so cool. I can use it with an app and everything. But actually, you know, if you want to cross a mountain or go a long distance, and especially if you don't have the expensive cars, the expensive electric vehicles with fast chargers, it's actually quite complicated to do road trips and transport things. It's very often that in politics, the ambitions far exceed what is actually doable. So, I mean, you have two possibilities. Either you set, the government sets a standard for what needs to be achieved in terms of reduction of CO2 emissions or a development of electric vehicles. And if that target would be naturally met, then you wouldn't need government regulation in the first place. But if it cannot be naturally met, then you need to slap fines on them, and then who pays those? That's usually also the consumer. What is interesting is that the sharing economy actually offers, especially those in the big cities, then those alternatives. Now, there's some cities that are better than others, and this is where I want to bring in Maria, because you've been looking at sharing economy availability quite a bit, and you've found that there's quite some differences within Europe. And I just want to get your take on why that is. Why is there this skepticism on the and this lack of availability on sharing economy services? And sort of also explain for those listeners who don't know exactly what the sharing economy is, sort of what services are aligned with that.
Thank you. So to start with, the CCC publishes the Sharing Economy Index. It's been our second year now. The index looks at the availability of various sharing economy services, starting from ride sharing, which would be Uber, Bolt, Yandex Taxi. There's various taxis in many different cities of Europe. Some are city specific, and then the availability of Airbnb, well, mainly Airbnb. There's obviously some city specific platforms. Then we look at e-scooters, car sharing, peer-to-peer car renting, gym sharing, and various some regulations specific to e-scooters, Airbnb, such as taxation, needs for specific permits, and so on. So sharing economy as such is something new for us. It's different from the supply chains we've been used to, because you have a platform facilitating a relationship between, so it's like a peer-to-peer relationship, because, for example, when we look at probably the most basic example would be the classic model of Uber, where you have someone who has a car and they're coming back from work. They can pick someone up on their way back home. So they just log into an Uber app. They probably upload their driving license in the easiest way. And then they can pick up a person. And sharing economy is different in the sense that it's all built on trust. So you trust strangers, and otherwise you probably wouldn't do that. But because you have this platform facilitating this relationship, there's this relationship of trust, which is unprecedented for many countries, especially probably for post-Soviet countries. And so the interesting thing about the findings of the sharing economy is that peer-to-peer economy is actually flourishing in Eastern Europe and not in Western Europe, where you expected to flourish. So some of the main cities, according to our findings, are Tallinn, Vilnius, Tbilisi, Kyiv, some Russian cities as well, and Stockholm, and then Oslo, Riga. So as you can see, it's mainly Northern or Eastern Europe. Most Western European countries, such as cities, to be more specific, such as Paris, Rome, Berlin, and all of the, mainly all the EU capitals, they have a bit of a higher level of regulation, especially when it comes to various permits, in particular when it comes to Uber and Airbnb. And the models they're using they're being a bit transformed, because in the classic model for the sharing economy, you would need to have an actual driver, like a person without specific taxi driver permits, without having to pay any taxation or anything. And now, for example, in Paris, or the best example would probably be Athens, where you don't have Uber, but you have Uber app. And when you can actually get a normal taxi by using an Uber app, which, if you think about it, is very, like, it's all getting a bit confused and adds up to the confusion about what the sharing economy actually is. In terms of regulation, I think it's best for governments not to try to intervene with the sharing economy, to just leave it alone, and so that it can expand and help consumers have more choice. Because if you think about it, if you try to book your, if you go on holiday and you have an option to get a hotel, if you can get an Airbnb and you can compare the prices, so you can see what's best for you. And if a couple of years ago it was just a hotel, and now you have Airbnb and you can see on the internet how Airbnb is expanding, in particular Airbnb, but there's of course many other sharing economy services, e-scooters now, they're just expanding, and because there's demands for that, because trust is getting crazy for those services, and as a result you can sort of get more options to choose from. So it's all very exciting to see these developments. So yeah, very exciting to see what's going to happen next.
Yeah, also tell us a bit about like your sharing economy experiences in Germany.
Okay, I'll tell that in a second, but I can just start with saying, as the oldest here of this panel, I can tell you how terrible travel was 10 years ago, pre-sharing economy and pre-mobile roaming data in another country. You always had to be worried to get ripped off by taxis, especially when you're traveling, because you don't know the prices. You had to get cash out of ATMs and pay a lot to just get cash out. I mean, now when you travel off, you don't even get cash, right? Because your apps are just charging you and you had no idea about the quality of things. I mean, these platforms really work as the arbiter, right? So they really help you to understand, okay, this is certain quality of driver. They can be ranked if they get too much negative feedback. They get removed from the platform. The same for Airbnb rentals. I mean, it just gives consumers so much more transparency and you don't need to speak the local language. Fortunately, when I was in India for the first time, which was a mixed experience, but the good thing, when I went to India the first time, they already had Uber. So at least I didn't get ripped off by a taxi driver. So that's probably the only positive thing that happened on that trip, but at least that. Yeah? My story in Berlin, where I lived for many years, was that Uber got banned in Berlin, which was probably one of the inspirations to start the Consumer Choice Center, to fight for the consumers who want to have choice, not for the corporations. But one thing the Berlin city government did when they banned Uber, they mandated taxis to accept credit card payments, because most taxi drivers do not like to accept credit cards. And they said you can only operate your taxi when you have a functioning credit card reader there. So it needs to work. So you cannot, which is for consumers, which is okay, actually, especially if you give taxis the monopoly, at least to kind of force them to accept credit cards. So now what happens is a lot of taxi drivers are waiting at the airport, to Tegel Airport, which doesn't exist anymore, but they're waiting for like a nice 40 euro fare to drive someone to the other end of the town. And a lot of these drivers are actually also on benefits. So they're officially actually on unemployment benefits, and they keep their additional income artificially low, because otherwise they would reduce the benefits would be reduced. That means they need a cash payment. Yeah? So... And that's why they really don't like the credit card payments. And they start a huge fight with you when you insist to pay a credit card. So it all culminated. So I always insisted taxi drivers to pay a card, and they got upset. And then sometimes I reported some drivers because there were actually high fines for drivers who are not complying with this. And my wife joined me in this little civil unrest against the taxi monopoly. And one evening she actually came back from work or from the train station in a taxi, and the driver locked her in and drove away when she refused to pay with credit card, cash. And the police had to get involved. Unfortunately, the police was siding with the driver because they didn't like people that want to pay with credit cards. But I think the entire story made it into Der Spiegel. And it at least led to a bit more enforcement of the credit card payment policy. Long story short, but I really do not like taxis.
Oh, sure. Yeah, absolutely.
So I'd like to think that I do. I also contributed to the sharing economy as I am a co-founder of a corporate carpooling app here in Georgia, a bit of advertising, allowing the employees to travel together, which we developed and tested out in Georgia with a pretty good feedback from the private sector. But what we realized is the complete lack of flexibility of the state to in any way regulate the market or, you know, assist the innovative, say, enterprises to thrive within the economy. I mean, to give you a specific example, not too long ago, the city hall of Tbilisi started a campaign against traffic, and their best idea being to make it as hard for drivers to drive around the city as possible. One of those being new parking spaces with an hourly pay. So we saw an opportunity, you know, since we are a startup that technically fights the traffic and our drivers contribute to that, maybe perhaps we could get some benefits on the on those hourly parking spaces. So we spent about 2 weeks in the city hall bureaucratic hell just to figure out, just to get to the person responsible for the entire idea. And what, even when we reached there, we just realized that there's complete lack of interest for them to involve any kind of innovative solutions on the market, simply because they don't understand it and they have little interest. So yeah, I mean, that kind of raises the question how, if mass government regulation has any place in today's society, not just being like a completely neutral in the innovator drive of the society, but actually being a hindering factor towards it. So, you know, as a first-hand experience, I can say that the latter is most definitely true.
I also just wanted to get Liz in as well. To you, being from the US, this must all seem a bit surreal, because as far as I understand, the sharing economy has more leeway in the States overall, but there's probably also outliers.
Yeah, I think the sharing economy in the US is pretty strong. We do see some regulation pop up now and again trying to limit, you know, how much and what type of products or services are allowed within the sharing economy. Uber definitely is huge in the U.S. It is continuing to expand. Obviously, it started out as just Uber and like the ride sharing. It turned into Uber Eats. Hopefully, they'll have like Uber Cannabis one day. They can just deliver cannabis to consumers. Same with Airbnb, also really huge. I mean, these are both Silicon Valley startups, so naturally, they've been very well adopted in the U.S. I think what's important is that we continue to really advocate for these types of services and make sure that consumers do have these options, because I think it is a true blessing for many, not only in the U.S., but around the world, as you guys have mentioned as well.
And if I can just quickly add, like from a social justice standpoint also, so food delivery, it's a great thing and has been developed a lot. There are people who want to deliver food, and there are people who want to order food, and there are apps that facilitate that, and you can even rank the restaurant quality, which is great. It connects a lot of small businesses and consumers with each other. And then you have the labor unions coming in and not liking it, because it's not the traditional, the gig economy is not the traditional model of people being employed. Yeah, you work for a couple of hours, and it all went so far that a company like Deliveroo left, for instance, the German market, or at least Berlin, because they got like problems with labor unions. And I mean, these are contractors, these are not employees, and it's like these legacy interest groups, if it's the taxi unions or the labor unions, that destroy the mutual beneficial exchange between consumers and these platforms and platform workers, which it's basically like 20th century legacy stuff making our 21st century a bit more complicated. And I mean, during lockdown, I think everyone ordered food, delivery food, and it was a blessing, because I cannot eat my own spaghetti bolognese 5 days in a row.
All right, I think that's our time. Thank you to the four of you for joining us. So that's Fred Roeder, Maria Chaplia, Liz Higgs, and Luca Zagagna. Thank you for tuning into the special episode of The Consumer, this time actually with video. And thank you to Luca Corbaglia, who you cannot see, but who's behind the camera and making us all look very pretty. So thanks, and tune in next time for The Consumer. And that concludes this very special broadcast episode of The Consumer Podcast. Next week, we will be back with a regular show, but I hope you enjoy this. It was a bit something else, having a bit of an exchange between the different CCC staff members. So, I'll see you soon. Please follow us on Twitter @ConsumerChoiceC, and see you Thursday. You have to learn.